Welcome back, folks, to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. On today's show, we are quite honored to have Simone Fenton Jarvis. Title, Group Director of Workplace Consultancy and Transformation at VPOD Solutions, author of The Human-Centric Workplace. Simone is a workplace thought leader who is passionate about creating human-centric workplaces. But at her most basic, what she does is focus on people. She hones in on the employee experience, workplace culture, and organizational performance, and uses data to deliver change and business improvement with respect to culture, space, process, and technology. Before we get to our conversation with her, though, Greg, we got to keep it easy, buddy. Stay easy. KeystoneTech.com. That's KeystoneTech.com.
And we're going to talk about the workplace environment. And one thing that Keystone has also relates a little to the workplace is canopy fixtures. Sometimes you have a covered outdoor application that you need, and they've got their Power and Color Select canopy fixture with a Keystone driver, built-in photocell sensor capability. You get 9 fixtures in one because of the selectability of it. Low profile, easy to install, easy to use, Keystone.
Get over to KeystoneTech.com. That's KeystoneTech.com. And of course, Greg, where it all started with the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. That's NAILD.org. Convention coming up, Greg, in September.
It is, yeah. America's convention.
Ooh,
Dallas,
yeah.
Texas. Get ready.
There's a little tour to go to the Dallas Cowboys where they play. We're going to check it out. And, of course, we're going to learn all sorts of stuff about lighting. If you're a lighting distributor, if you're a darkness fanatic, if you are a lighting controls person, you got to join NAILD. Go to NAILD.org. Welcome to the show, Simone.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you. Greg, you know, as guys that sell light bulbs every day, I don't know where exactly to start with Simone. Do you have any good ideas of how to enter into this conversation?
Well, it talks about the human-centric workplace. So let's get into what, I mean, I can guess what you mean, but why don't you define what you mean by that and then tell us what you do.
Yeah, sure. So essentially, the human-centric workplace started off really as how can we start putting people at the heart of the organisation rather than profit? It doesn't have to be a this or that, but essentially a lot of the time profit comes before people, and my ethos is that's wrong, and it's not the way that we should be doing business today. And then also bring in the fact that profit often comes before the planet as well. And again, that's even more wrong. So my day-to-day job really is to work with organisations on how to improve their culture, how to improve the physical spaces and the technology that they use to enable their people to do their job in a way that benefits the organisation, enhances their well-being, their sense of belonging and connection to the company, and doesn't have a negative impact on the planet.
So what got you into this?
Oh, I, like most people, I fell into facilities management about 15 years ago now, and I fell into facilities management, and my career's just evolved from there, really. And then during the pandemic, a publisher reached out to me and said, oh, do you fancy writing a book? We've been following you for a while. We like your blogs. You know, do you want to write a book? And I was like, yeah, I'll write a book. We're in the middle of a pandemic. I've got nothing else to do. So, yeah, why not? I'll write a book. Bit crazy, really. And, yeah, nearly 2 years on, and here I am. So, yeah.
That's a tall order, what you said there. That's a really tough challenge, yeah. Greg. I just want to make that comment, and then I'll let you go. Keep going, Greg.
Yeah, no, I'm just curious. So are you still in facilities management, or are you full-time author now and out of that biz?
Yeah, I wish. No, I'm going to say I wish, but maybe I don't, actually. So work as a consultant, working with organisations, so supporting the facilities management that is in-house. I work with the facilities managers now. So I don't operationally day-to-day manage facilities anymore. Just more kind of swoop in and save or support people where they need me, and then swoop back out again. So yeah, it's a lot better for me now because it means that I can shut off at weekends and evenings, unlike most facilities managers. So I kind of get best of both worlds, really.
Where's the demand coming from? Because if you know a lot of companies, you say put profit before people, but where who's reaching out to you and why and who's paying for it? You know?
So the organizations that reach out really are the ones that sometimes they just don't know what the issue is. So they might be having high churn in their organization. They might be looking at their competitors and thinking, why have our people left and gone to a competitor? So essentially, they understand that they need to change something. And then often as well, it might just be, we've had our engagement survey results back, and actually, we know that engagement's low. People are not engaged with our purpose. They're not engaged with the communications that are coming from senior or even mid management. Can you come and help us? So that's typically where I get involved. And it might also be we're in the middle of doing a fit out or a redesign of our workplace. We don't actually know what we need to do. Can you come and help? So yeah, it's quite a broad range, really.
I studied a geography at university, and I took a course on social geography, and that's a way the way that people interact with their spaces. And then I lived in Belfast for a year, where you had the Catholics and the Protestants, and how they would move through the spaces. Like there was this imposed separation that was chosen by the people in that town. So it's interesting. It sounds very similar, except on the interior. Like what you're doing is sort of like you started by changing light bulbs, and now you're into analyzing why people don't want to or want to be in a space.
Yeah, essentially it is. It's the, from a people, process, tech, space point of view, why do people like being there and why do they not like being there? And obviously in the world now that we're in post-pandemic, how can we get people to go back into a workplace that might have a lease on it for the next 15 years? And we know that it's not a space that's going to be kind of cold in the culling that is going on at the moment. So actually, how can we make it a place that people want to come to rather than forced to come to? Because, that's for me, like there's obviously examples of certain leaders that are forcing people back to the office, but I'm definitely not an advocate for that. So it's more of how can we attract people instead.
So lighting, our electric lighting plays a role in that, as does daylighting and fenestration and these types of things, windows and so on. But to just before we start getting into the specifics of the technical part of lighting, which is the focus of the show, I want to ask you, like, so when you're looking at a facility, if there is, let's say acrimony in the air, that's part of facilities management to remove the acrimony.
So, well, facilities management done right. I think, it's got a bit of a bad rap, as in facilities management for years has been known as the bogs and the brushes. Actually, facilities management done right is they're the hub of the office. They know people. They know what's going on in the office. They know what tech people need. They know what spaces people are using. They know the names and the cats and the dogs. And, they should just be that kind of community leader almost, and bringing that people together in the organization. But yeah, that's where really we look at lighting as a facilities management point of view. And I remember actually a few years ago, I upgraded a building that I was managing. I upgraded all the lighting to LED. And I remember the feedback today, because it had gone from like the really dull halogen yellow horrible lighting to like almost like 60s workplace, to this new LED kind of high energy efficient, a little bit more control, where you could turn it on and off in certain areas or even turn it down. And I remember the impact of that when people were just like, wow, I can't believe how much difference this has made. And this was a building that was surrounded by windows as well. So lighting wasn't necessarily an issue, but we didn't necessarily understand the damage that the halogen lights were causing at the time. And even the heat that was coming out of them, and then how that was combating the air conditioning as well. That was a massive thing.
Yeah, well, you know what, the actual, that's an interesting point. In Canada, where it's quite cold, you actually have a, there's actually heat, some of the savings from LED have transitioned, Greg, into more work for the HVAC in the winter and less work for the air conditioning in the summer. It's actually an interesting that buildings are creating their own heat by using electrical devices, and interesting. So where does the physical experience of the human start, and where does the environmental side of it begin? So like you have this kind of pressure between the two, right? There's, it's not, it's not seamless, human-centric lighting and environmental. Well, like there's payoff, there's trade-offs there. How do you determine those? And talk a little bit about
Yeah,
that.
I think, yeah, if you'd have asked me before the pandemic, I think my answers would have been totally different. I think now, today, it's, you know, that person works that wakes up in the morning and it's a, where am I going to work today? And it's a, why am I working there? What am I going there for? Who am I going to be working with? And they'll obviously then make a decision of, do I stay at home? Do I go to a coffee shop, a co-working space, or an office? So actually, the journey starts earlier than just walking into the office. So if people have got a poor home setup, and that could be right down to lighting, ergonomics, everything, you know, heat, especially in the middle of an energy crisis, you know, that's going to affect how productive and how effective people are and how happy they're going to be at work. So I think the journey starts much earlier than we even realize. And there's a big, obviously, big thing at the moment in facilities management of, you know, is this hybrid way of working really going to affect the industry and our roles? And actually, it's no, not if you pivot quick enough, because facilities management doesn't have to be necessarily about that physical office that you've always been managing and always been working in. Facilities management is about people, because buildings without people in are really easy to manage. I've done it. So actually, it's facilities management is about how can we get people effective in that space, which it might be the home space, it might be the co-working space, it might be the coffee shop. What do people need to work? And that's where facilities management actually can step in. And obviously, you know, I know it's happening in the UK. I think Canada's kind of lagged a little bit further behind, but around the whole transition from facilities management to workplace, and actually how workplace is the whole journey, the whole experience. But it's coming, and I think that's can only be a positive thing.
Do you feel that it's going to ever go back to how it was? I mean, is there always going to be that hybrid aspect? I'd give the example of my wife was a teacher. She always had to go to a facility. Now she's an instructional designer. And every day she's like, yeah, I don't need to go into the office to do this. I sit at my computer at my cube and I Zoom call with the person that's over in this office. I can Zoom call from home and save a 20-minute drive. You know, and I think to your point, that's what oftentimes people are thinking now. And in the past, it was just, this is where I go every day. Are we ever going to get back to this is where I go every day?
I don't think it'll be every day. I think we like a little bit like fashion, I think it'll come back round again. And it'll just kind of evolve. I don't think it'll come back 5 days a week back in the office, because I think we've all kind of seen a better way of living. But I do think that there's a need for getting people together in that space. And that space got to be right when people get there. Otherwise, it's going to push them even further along the line of working elsewhere. But to get that space right, the space is one big thing, but the next bit is the people have got to be there. We don't want to go and work in an empty office because everybody else is working from home that day. So we've got to be better at coordinating people to get to the actual space. And I think once we've got back together, I think everyone's gone, oh, I forgot how nice this was. I thought, you know, I can see the value of the office, because, and I think that's the point that we're at the moment. People are now connecting with people again. We've got used to being back in the same room as other people and gone, actually, yeah, I like this, but I don't want to do it every day of the week. I don't want to do it 5 days of the week.
So what is let's say somebody reached out to you and wanted you to come and provide your services. What's the first thing you do when you go to a facility?
Yeah, so I would sit in the organisation, and I wouldn't necessarily, you know, arrange meetings or anything. It's I just go and sit and work in their office and have a look around, watch people, not in a creepy way, but I'm there observing the space and kind of soaking up the culture. I think it's always a really good test, you know, look at the noise levels. Is the people there in rows of desks with headsets on having Teams calls? And there's an empty meeting room, and actually, all of them people could have gone into that meeting room, but they didn't realize that they're all sat in the office, and that's a regular thing that I'm seeing at the moment. So just observing things like that and the behaviors, you know, when somebody takes a coffee cup back to the kitchen, do they wash the mug or do they just put it on the side? That's a good sign of culture. And it's all these little things. You know, when someone leaves a meeting room, do they push a chair back in or do they just walk out and just leave in whatever state? And it's all of these little things of going, do you respect and value the place that you're in? Or are you just seeing it as a bit of a student doss, really? So.
That's interesting. I have to say, like that perspective So you start your proposals off with, I'm just going to hang out in your space for a while and see what it's like.
Yeah, and it's
I've often told Greg that if I'd rather see the space that someone left behind where they lived rather than interview them for a job. Like if I would be able to tell more about that person by seeing the place they left that morning and how they live and if their dishes are filled with, if their sink is filled with dishes and their bed's unmade and the laundry's piling out of the thing, I'd probably know more about that person from just seeing where they lived for 5 minutes than from sitting down and listening to them lie to me or not lie to me. I don't know.
No, exactly. And most workplace consultants, the kind of gig starts with, oh, we're going to do a survey. Well, is what you get from a survey is the answer that the person wants to give. It might not be the truth, it's just the answer that they want to give. So actually go look for yourself and use your experience to go and feel what the space feels like. And by watching people and getting that sense, and even just having the ad hoc conversations like, oh, how long have you worked here? Do you like working here? That's really valuable. And I much prefer to start there than just start with a quite a soulless survey, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So when you look at this, you look at the people, you look at the surroundings, and you start looking at equipment. And does and when you look at equipment, does do you take energy efficiency into account, or you just say, the output of light, like we'll take lighting for example, or the temperature, or whatever it might be. How do you factor that all in?
Look at equipment, even simple things like you watch a group of people about to go into a meeting room. How long does it actually take them to connect to that meeting, that VC equipment? Because that's wasted minutes. What happens during that time? Are people silent and awkwardly looking out the window, or are they talking and just connecting with them as colleagues? Again, that's a sign of the culture. I think from an energy efficiency point of view, depends what people are looking for, really. If somebody came to me and said, I want a smart building survey, like a smart score, then yes, we would look at the energy efficiency. It would be everything to do with lighting and heating, what the building management system's doing, and how what the usage of that organisation is. Because if, like now, we've got floors and floors and spaces of masses of space and minimal people using them, then that's very inefficient. So again, there's a certain days of the week where we can start condensing our spaces down. So on a, let's say Monday and Friday, for the sake of the argument that's ongoing, Mondays and Fridays we don't open all 5 floors, we actually only open 2 floors. So I think that's where having the data can obviously drive them efficiencies then. But when we are running at a normal operating, it just makes sense to have that, right. Like, why would we not want our heating and our lighting to be energy efficient, especially in the world where it's costing through the roof?
What's interesting, I have a it's I'll tell you an anecdote from the lighting sales front lines. Okay, when it comes to lighting controls, which are very it's very popular now to talk about advanced or integrated or connected lighting controls, these different words, right? And it's very popular to talk about this stuff now, but I was in lighting controls when they were dumb, okay? And they were just, the best you could get was like low voltage relays that you could connect multiple sensors to low voltage so they communicated with each other and stuff like that. But I could never sell this on ROI because it, after you did the lighting energy efficiency upgrade, there wasn't that many watts left to control, to turn off and on. And so the lighting rebate, the lighting project would have, say, a year and a half or 2 year payback. And then the lighting controls would be 5 or 7 or 10 years to pay back. And so not a lot of people actually went forward with these proposals. Okay, just simply because the financial aspect of it didn't make sense. But I hate it when people leave lights on. Okay, it absolutely drives me completely crazy. And when my kid was asked the other day in his class, someone asked him, how often do your parents on your case to turn off their lights? And every student in the class put up their hands except one, my son. And he's like, how come you don't have sensors in your home to turn off the lights automatically? Okay. And so what I've noticed from the few customers that actually did advanced lighting controls in their facilities or their parking garages or this sort of thing, the number one benefit they got from the people was it felt like energy efficiency. It felt like this building was working properly. We don't have time to turn the lights off. We automate everything else. We don't need another thing to remember to do. The maintenance supervisor leaves his lights on in his office all the time. Turn your damn lights off. You're talking about pennies. You're creating acrimony. But when you give that guy a sensor so he does not have to think about the lights anymore, it's a wonderful gift, Simone, actually.
Yeah, it is. And do you know what drives me crazy as well is when you look across London post normal working hours and it's lit up like a Christmas tree. And it's like, why is London lit up when there's clearly nobody in these office spaces? I'm sure it's the same, Toronto, Montreal, anywhere, any of them cities. It's like, why? Like, I don't, there's no excuse for it. And it's not
Well, there is
just,
an excuse. There's not enough people that know how to do lighting controls properly. And I'm going to say that, Greg, from the beginning. Do you know how many lighting controls projects are completely and totally screwed up by amateurs? Almost all of them.
Yes. I can imagine the amount of electricians that I've worked with over the years that say, I'm a lighting control specialist, I can change your lights because I'm an electrician. That's a very different skill to actually getting lighting in an office efficiently working. It's not about just getting an electrician in to do the electrics.
Lighting controls deployment in a differentiated environment is a skill that is learned through experience doing it. Okay? So I have a lot of experience deploying, designing, and making like spaces be able to be viewed by a sensor and lights turned off. Okay? And what's happening is people think it's magic done by a computer on an app. That's actually not true. And they think when they turn on the app, Greg, with these controls, that everything's going to magically connect and work because there's an app for that. And there's no app for the skills of laying out a properly functioning passive infrared or ultrasonic control system into a bathroom so the lights actually go off, Simone, and are not kept on by something else. It's very difficult. So, but when it's done right, Greg, when it's done right, oh man, do people love it.
To do it right costs money,
I
though, and that's
know.
the hard part
Yeah.
for
I mean,
people.
you can do it on the not on the cheap because that's not the great way, but even as an individual, I've got light sensors in my house as on the cheap, the kind of the Google Hive system. And I've got my heating connected up, lighting, and all these little sensors dotted around my house. So yes, if I there's no movement in my house, the lights go off. And it's not just because of energy, it just seems normal. You don't leave a light in a room when you leave the room. And if I go into a room, I'm going to turn a light on. So why would I not let a sensor do that for me?
Not
So
only
even
that,
as
though,
a
but why do I want to worry about lights being on or off?
Peace of mind, right?
Like, I don't even worry about it anymore at my house. The lights just go on when they go on, they go off when they go off. And nobody's there.
It
And
seems.
you don't have to compromise anything. And guess what? It doesn't even need to be connected to a computer, okay? I want to do a challenge with the Lighting Controls podcast, which is related to us, by the way. There's a Lighting Controls podcast, Simone. I have a challenge. I'll throw it out a challenge to those guys. I can get more energy efficiency than them from dumb sensors in the same space. They can have all the Bluetooth and computers they want, and I'll deliver more energy savings with just stupid passive infrared, low voltage and line voltage occupancy sensors. It's actually, if you know how to do it, you can deliver a lot of results there, Simone.
How do you stop your sensors falling off the ceilings? That's what I'm intrigued about. I've worked a lot with sensors over the years, and it feels like the number one issue that always happens is the sensor falls off.
Well, I would say buy better sensors would be the first thing because they should never fall off. But also, we're connecting these things into the electrical infrastructure. So there's a be a hardwire box that you would screw it into, and you would connect it to the lighting circuits. I don't know that much, Greg, about the Bluetooth side of it, but I imagine the mechanical connections would be very similar, would they not?
They would, but I think it's the mounting of it. Sometimes there can be issues with it. A lot of times it's that double-sided tape. If you're doing wireless, for example.
Oh yeah. See again, the wireless. That's
It's the wireless that has always been a challenge. Like, whether it's been occupant sensors, lighting sensors, the second that something's wireless and you're relying on a certain Velcro strip, let's say, they fall off and it drives the end occupier insane.
easier to install, tougher to maintain. You know, that's the deal with it.
And it's yeah, it's like, if you're expecting to put them there for any length of time, you're better off just hardwiring them because you don't have to think about it.
Right. And in terms of the human-centric side of the workplace and lighting, you know, a lot of times you mentioned a story about just going to LED and how it made a difference. But now the talk in lighting is that we need to have it color changing and intensity, you know, dimming outputs, different outputs, even locations of lighting. Are you getting into that, or are you just sticking to the basics in terms of what the work you do?
Yeah, no, I stick to what I do really. It's I think you can quite quickly become jack of all trades, master of none when you're working in facilities and office environments. I would, I've got people that I would work with, and it is this organization needs improved lighting. Okay, let's work with them. It might be acoustics, let's work with them. So I think you sometimes the more you know, the more dangerous it gets, and you have to kind of draw the line. So I know what's needed from lighting, as in it needs to be energy efficient, and I need to be able to see. But I would definitely leave the rest to the experts.
There you go. So you're not seeing a lot of it in the field where people are doing color tuning or a lot of dimming in the applications you're working in?
Yeah, a little bit. I think the we've worked in this, we've worked in our homes for that long now that I think when people are going back to the office, they're expecting this hyper personalized space. So they do want to be able to control the light. And I think 80% of the offices in the UK, you can't control the lighting. It is, one person and it'll be the whole floor. You can't control an area of the lighting. And I think that is a problem when you've got people doing different tasks, people that have got different sensitivities. You might have people that are neurodivergent. You need to be able to control your space. I don't like working with massive bright lights in front of me. Some people do. There's all the web developers that I've worked with over the years, and they're like, "I just want you to turn the lights off. I just want to sit in a dark room." And it's just how they want to work. So why can't we offer that in a workplace? Why do we rely on there's all these grid lighting systems above our head and it's all going to be turned on by one light switch? It's insane.
Yeah, that's where, this is where there's all these shooting stars that want to collide with one another, right? And there's those two that are on a collision course with each other. One is tunability, the other is circadian. You can't have both. Like, either you're giving people the option to control their lighting intensely or in some way, or you're going to give them circadian stimulus. They can't have both of those things, because and just anecdotally, Greg, what do pe when you offer people an ability to dim lights, what do?
Dim the lights?
They dim them. The first thing they
Yes.
do is go and lower the light output. That's the
Yeah.
first thing they do. And if you, I don't care what you could say, oh, that's not a double blind placebo study. Yeah, I don't care. If you give someone a dimmer in the workplace, the first thing the people go and do is dim them to about 50%. Maybe they go back up a little bit. That is anti-circadian right off the top, right? Circadian wants to blast people with lumens. I don't know if that's ever going to make it in, Greg.
I don't either. Yeah, that's the hard part, is it's all the talk right now, but is it actually getting done? Who knows?
I don't
I
think
think
people are going to
people
want that.
pay more attention to it. I think people are paying more attention to it, and especially in like the especially the home working because the amount of people now that are using like the SAD lamps, the high lumen, to improve circadian rhythm and sleep and everything. I think people are getting used to using that in their home environments. So I think when that happens, it's only natural that then that request and that movement goes into the workplace. So I think it'll happen over time. Because I think people are kind of, getting there on that and the importance of light and daylight. And I think, in winter in England, and obviously I know Canada's the same, you have a lot of daylight and a lot of dark nights. And when you're going to work in the night and like in the dark, and then you're coming home in the dark, you're a bit like, oh God, like when's the sun going to come out again? So actually, I think people are being, you only have to look at the growth of the different kind of like home setup lamps and stuff now and bed lamps and all that kind of stuff. So I think people are starting to take that a bit more seriously. Like the more research that's been done, the the more mainstream I think it's becoming. So I do think, I hope, maybe it's a hope rather than a think, but I think, people will take that into the workplace soon. And there's a few offices that I can think of actually in the UK that have basically looked at circadian rhythm, and they've advised people that, they've got to get so many lumens a day and stuff like that. So maybe it's coming.
What's interesting, Greg, there are proven ways now that we can mimic the effect of outdoor lighting. But I think the most attractive one, Greg, the one that's going to be have the most penetration, and it's going to start on the high end and then it's going to get cheaper and cheaper, are these light fixtures that look exactly like windows or skylights. And the impression is that you're actually looking at a frosted window, not a light fixture. I think when we get to that point, and I'm going to order one for the producer's office here, but where you're dropping in what is basically a frosted skylight into somebody's place, you're going to have a psychological adaptation to that. And Greg, if they add this near infrared play to it, to those. So anyone developing products out there, listen to me, because I'm telling you about the number one product. If you had the perception that somebody was viewing the outdoor lighting through a troffer or through a wall, and you mixed into that some near infrared, you would be really producing the psychological and physiological effects of sun exposure. I'm not kidding you. Like that they, because the person will psychologically or believe that it's a skylight, they'll think, oh, I'm looking at the sun, because it actually mimics the sun in London that day. And then the if you were to hit them with that near infrared, they would have that stimulus they get from the other spectrums, and you would improve human health outcomes for sure. How's that for facilities?
So
That's
I totally agree. And do you know what it was? I think 2017, I got some light LED panels that mimic, and I put them in this well-being area that we kind of just designed and fitted out. And actually, people loved it because they'd go in, it'd be like, oh, it is literally like we can see the sky, and it made such a big difference. And I think when you look at biophilia, it's so easy to get drawn into, oh yeah, we're going to add more plants into the office. But nowhere in nature do you see plants growing up a wall and moss growing up a wall and like, oh yeah, but that's what we're going to put in our offices. And then you've got, oh, we're still going to have lighting that is a grid lighting system that just still looks like something that's been man-made. It's got to be more natural if we want the true effects of biophilia. You can't just keep being in this way. So I totally agree that it's got to mimic the natural world the best it can.
One thing that's interesting about your title, the human-centric workplace. I don't know that we can ever get to that point. It's like an ever-achieving goal, right? Like we're you can always
I
be
have a
more
point though.
human-centric.
I have a point I want to make
You can
after
never be,
Simone responds.
yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm just interested in your opinion on that, because it's like, hey, I'm going to make your place human-centric. Yeah, but then in, you could do more, and you could do more, and there's certain places you can't do a lot at, but is it, are you ever going to achieve your goal of making a human-centric workplace?
I don't ever believe that there's a start and a finish. And I know that kind of might drive some people, especially the CFO, a little bit crazy, but a workplace should never be finished. And the human-centric bit should never be finished because our needs are changing constantly. And not only are needs changing, but if you look at how quickly technology is advancing, our needs are changing in line with that. And then what you can offer from a human-centricity point of view is also changing in line with that. So I don't, years ago I used to think, oh, will we ever get to this point? And it was quite a depressing thought, really. But I think over the years, what I have come to is the conclusion of actually, if we think we're done, probably failed, because actually you should never be done. You should always be
Oh, stop it.
reiterating and evolving.
That you know the that but that goes for everything, folks. All things are continuous improvement, right? Like that's the universe is works that way. That's evolution, whatever your definition of that kind of thing. We're moving forward into the future, and we're always going to need to improve and make it better. Let me and sometimes we take steps back, actually. And the lighting industry has taken a massive step back with some of this LED stuff, Greg. Like
agree.
it's like people listen, you can't be ripping fixtures out of ceilings every 5 years, okay? That's not a business model that's going to work for sustainability. But here's what I want to ask Simone before while I went on my little rant about sustainability, which is a personal rant I have, Simone. But here's one something I want to ask you. Sometimes the best thing about coming to work for a lot of people is leaving work behind. Right? And I don't I think that a lot of people haven't thought about that enough. That, you know, while working from home for some is very convenient and excellent and they love it, there's other people that, you know, they kind of got sucked into working 12 hours a day and they felt like their home was invaded by the workplace. And maybe they actually appreciate the physical separation of home and work. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, and like it was the same for me. I was working for a Canadian company during the pandemic, and I was obviously, 3,000 miles away from my colleagues. So I was essentially stuck in my home working, and I had no option, even if I wanted to go to an office. So I've got personal experience of this, and you do start climbing the walls a little bit. And since I've changed jobs, one of the massive things with me for was, can I go to an office at some point? And it's just having that separation, mixing things up a little bit and seeing people in the flesh. And I think, all of the work that I've done throughout the pandemic and like before that as well, people really struggle when they've not got boundaries. And actually we're really poor at maintaining our own boundaries, if we've not been learned how to set them. So not to get too deep, but obviously it goes right back to childhood. But essentially we need to know where our lines are, but we also need to set them red lines for ourselves. And we need to have them lines of saying, I'm logging off at this time and I'm gonna not just leave my laptop on the kitchen table, I'm gonna pack it away and put it in my bag. Work's done for the day, I don't wanna see it. I think the issue starts happening when the laptop's left open on the kitchen table. You start cooking tea and think, oh, I'll just pop on there and do something in a minute. And then an hour later, you're going, oh, I might as well carry on now. And I've been sat here an hour. And then you've got your other half screaming at you. But it's too easy. So you've got to be disciplined. And I think we can't blame home working or the organisations for our lack of boundaries. I think we need to really be intentional about what the balance looks like between home, work, life. So.
I think about that what you just said there. And I think when you're talking about setting boundaries and maintaining boundaries, and I'll tie this into lighting somehow, Greg Eric, I promise. But the you know if you have to enforce your boundaries, it means that you don't have any. Okay, so when people say like you've crossed my boundaries, or when somebody you get an email saying and they write back to you, I don't answer email after 6 o'clock, but it's 7:15. Right? Well, why did you answer me? Right? You understand what I'm saying? And so, like, if your boundary is that you work until 5 o'clock, anything that you do for your company after that, including taking a call on your cell phone from your boss when you don't have to, including answering an email or anything like that, is you sabotaging your own boundaries. It's not the other people. Okay? And you teach people, if you're going to work from home, you teach people how to treat you, which is goes to my next point that I wrote down, but it wasn't about lighting, so I didn't say it. But if you're going to work from home, in my opinion, Simone, you're kind of that you're neither an employee nor are you an independent consultant. You know, there's something that is different about you if you used to come to the office every day before COVID, and now you don't come to the office every day. There's something, it's a different type of relationship. I don't think it should be called an employee. And you need to be able, the type of person that can supervise yourself. And if you can't supervise yourself, don't work from home, because you're going to go crazy. Done. You're going to procrastinate. If you're a procrastinator, if you laugh and joke with your friends about how much you procrastinate, you should not work at home unsupervised. It's not going to be good for you. You know? And so there's different types of people that maybe the facility managers has to say, listen, your personality type does not qualify for home working, actually. Like, there's got to be, because certain people cannot do this and never will be able to do it.
Yeah, so it's interesting that actually. So I work with a company, and they've done 5 6 years of R&D science between what does autonomy and isolation look like. So actually, part of the work that I do is we measure can people work basically in isolation, and if it's no. And generally, people are not 100% no. It's generally like, I think the highest is probably about 70% no. So for them people, it'd be right, one day a week, you work in isolation. You can cope with that, or equivalent to one day a week. But actually, the rest of the time, you need to be around colleagues because a lot of people work because they know they can see stuff happening around them, and they're driven by that, and they're driven by other people, and it almost feels like that kind of knock-on effect and domino effect. Some people are awful at working at home, but I think you're still an employee. It's just you're an employee with flexibility, and I think what organizations need to do is recognize that even if that person is awful at working from home, you still need to give them the chance to do that because they will go and find a company that will allow them to do it. So you don't want to lose talent just because you're going, actually, they're not the greatest. It's actually, how can we enable them to work from home? So, do they have all the tools and tech? Do they have the line manager actually guiding them? Are they really clear about what their job is and how they're being managed? Because just because people are in the office doesn't mean that they're being productive. We know that forever.
Sure.
So, you've got the same issue of people sitting in the office and being really ineffective. So, I think it goes both ways. I don't think it's an easy answer. But yeah, I think it goes
I'm going to
back
add to
to
what you
being
just
human.
said there. I
Yeah.
only hire people when I'm interviewing people now, and I just hired someone, my, you know, but Scott, the producer, knows this person. What I talked to them a lot about was the importance of leaving work behind and having their weekends and evenings to themselves. And I really tested that in that person, and that person was very attracted to that. You know, yeah, you don't have to have your email on your phone, and I don't even want to know your cell phone number. Oh, what do you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you just come here between 9 and 5, that will be it. And I will th there will be no contact with you after 5 p.m. on weekdays or on Saturday or Sunday. And so when I'm interviewing people, I'm looking for people that want that. And I want to employ those people because I need to work with my, as a manager, I can't, like, forget about just the employees. I cannot remotely manage anybody. Ask Greg. Talk about the nailed administrator. You know, I cannot effectively manage people if they're not present with me. So as an employer, I know that. And so I have to hire people that do not expect to work at home and have no desire to work from home and don't want that option.
Do you think you're missing out on talent though, then? Is it that not I'm managing this certain way, therefore I will get other leaders in the organization that will manage a different way because we'll attract different people? So you know your boundary. It's not their boundary, it's yours. It's a I
It's a
know I manage this
failure of me. It's my
way.
failure that I can't hire that talent. It's not their fault, it's my
Yeah.
fault. Right?
Yeah.
So the only people that I'm willing to remotely work with are people that are motivated by pay and get a piece of the action. And so I'm not paying them a salary or anything like that. And like, listen, I'm a paranoid boss. If I don't know if someone's being productive and working towards my goals, if I don't know that, I start paying attention to them a lot. And phone calls and trying to pay attention to someone who's not with you, if they need training, if they need support, if they don't know what they're doing, I can't figure that out. So I can't employ them because I don't know how to see when they're in need of my support. As an employer, I can't see it. I have no visibility into what they're doing. And so it's a failure of me as a manager to be able to do that. But if somebody's willing to say, I'll take 50% of the gross profit of every sale I make for you, yeah, sure, work on your own. You can never come into the office then. You know what I'm saying? So that for me as a manager, you know, I don't know how people do it. Have you seen this with other companies where they struggle to manage people that are working remotely?
Yeah, and I think what's happened is that evolution of the leader. I think it's there's a I'm going to say traditional way of leading people, which is if you're not in front of me, I can't manage you. and that's the traditional what people are used to. And now it's more along the lines of, you know what you need to do, I'm trusting you to do it in the right way, and you'll be measured on the output and the contribution that you're making. And if that contribution isn't right, we're going to be talking. And I think there's it goes back to the leadership style. And I think, you know, it's a...
Well, how do you introduce the human touch? How do you introduce the human touch into that? Because it sounds like we have an algorithm. We have an algorithm running on you. And we, hey, you know, you're free to stay at home all day, but this algorithm's going to tell us whether you're worth continuing to pay or not. Like, how do you deal with that part of it?
Yeah, definitely don't do it via algorithms. And it's about what work's being done. So let's say a typical salesperson, how many meetings have they had in the week? How many meetings have led to a proposal? How many leads have led to an actual sale? So you look at it over that time, and that is, you know, is that person successful? Do they need to be in front of you to get that output? No, you can measure that in a different way. There's loads of CRM systems out there that can do that. So actually, it's that person doesn't need to be in front of you. You just need to have the clear measures and boundaries of, as an organization, this is what we're expecting from you. We're expecting you to have this many meetings. We're expecting you to have this many phone calls or whatever, this many proposals sent out in the quarter, and this is your pipeline. And actually, does it matter if that person's in the office or working remotely, as long as they go tick, 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 I've done my job? It's just got to have clarity over what you're expecting from the person. And I think there's too many organizations that struggle with a problem in their organization. And instead of getting to the bottom of the problem, they'll go and recruit another 5 people because they think it's a resourcing issue.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's not a resourcing issue. It's an accountability and responsibility issue.
This is going to be very difficult for small to medium-sized companies, Greg, what she's talking about.
I agree.
Yeah. I mean, I've worked for companies of, and I'm literally like, so throughout my career, I've gone from 1,000 person organization to 35 person organization to 260,000 person organization globally, 26 billion turnover, crazy, crazy size. I'm now in an organization with 25 people. So I've seen all the extremes, and like now as a business leader of 25 people, I know the importance of making sure that people have got clarity, how they're going to be accountable, and it goes back to respect. And actually, if you can't trust somebody to work from home, you probably shouldn't be trusting them to work in your business at all. Because
I disagree with that wholesale. Really? I disagree with that.
Yeah.
I do. Yeah. I do. I think that there's people that you can trust to work from home, and there's people that you can't trust to work from home, but that doesn't mean that you can't trust them, period. I am an employer, and I know that there's people that work for me that can never work from home. And I know that there's people that if I was to set it up, like if I had the resources to set up one of those systems, the CRM systems you're talking about, for one person, because they're setting it up for 1,000 people or 100 people, right? And so there's actually a cost savings there because they get metrics and it works good for them. When you're dealing with smaller companies, you're talking about sending one person home and how do you make sure that person's effective? There are people that work for me that could never work from home. And some of them have to physically pack boxes and install light fixtures. You know what I'm saying? So there are tradesmen and warehouse workers and that, right? Mm-hmm. So this laptop class, the top of everyone, that gets to work from home is not all jobs, right? So
no, it's definitely not. And obviously working in facilities management, you can't go and say to a landscape gardener, you're going to go work from home. You won't get much done.
Yeah.
So there's got to be a balance between the perks and the benefits of working for the organization, but where the role can be done elsewhere, mm-hmm. I do believe that should be, that flexibility should be on offer. And I think there will be people that if you can't trust to work from home, there will be people in your organization today that might look really, really busy and probably not getting that much done. Just because they look busy doesn't mean they've been that effective. And they will be messing around the second that your back's turned. Mm. So actually, what difference does it make?
One more, because I'm kind of pushing back. I think this is a good conversation. I'm actually enjoying this because your perspective is enlightening me, on this, the way, a different way to think about it, which is what I like to do. But the only way we can do that is if we kind of discuss this. And I don't totally agree with you again. When you're thinking about, you know, oftentimes when, and I'm going to shut it down after this one, Greg, but oftentimes when you're thinking about, you know, people working in a space, right? And there's all these cries since the pandemic that it's almost a human right to be able to work from home. You know, I should, this is absolutely part of the healthy well-being, right? And then as I'm talking to you, I realize that, hey, there are jobs that people don't have that option, period. You can't, you could never work from home. And so what is wrong with this laptop office crowd that there's so many of them that believe that employers should not have the right to demand full-time office and discriminate against those that don't want to do that? Like, why is that just this laptop class that feels this and the gardeners and the carpenters of the world just can't make that case?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And, like, you know, I've deployed different workplace strategies over the last few years, even where it's, you know, almost a flexible working is not, it shouldn't be a benefit. It shouldn't be a perk for working for an organization. It should be a given. But actually, it's a given for some roles. Therefore, how do you balance it off with people that haven't got that kind of privilege? Mm-hmm. So, okay, so is the difference here the landscape gardeners? They can't work from home, so they can, on the middle of a Monday afternoon, go to the dentist like a laptop kind of privileged person could because they're working from home, they can just get away with it. Therefore, actually, the landscape gardener, okay, we're going to manage you as a human being. You're not going to start making your book half-day holiday because you need to go to the dentist on Monday afternoon. You're just going. So I think there's a way that you can manage people and balance things out, even in that small organisation. I've got quite a few cases and stuff that I can share with you after this of just how things can be done in a small organisation. And like I said, the organisation I'm in now, 25 of us, we've got a CRM system. It's really little or no cost, but it means that people can work from other places. And there is a cost benefit, not just in a square footage, but in a well-being. You can look at well-being, you can look at effectiveness, productivity. There's so many benefits that come off the back of it as well, which we are measuring. And, you know, I could come work with your organization and go, right, let's measure it.
I got one more question about this, right? What I found is I have a certain amount of flexibility, you know, in my office, but, you know, what I've always been sort of concerned about is some people learn to monopolize all the flexibility. So there are some people that in that hybrid relationship you talked about that seem to, you know, when we're all going to work together, it's a small environment, we're going to help each other out to cover for each other and all this kind of stuff, because in a small company, you don't have the same resources, right? You can't push, oh yeah, overflow goes to our call center in the Philippines button, right? We don't have that. So, you know, but I found that, or, you know, I observed over time that, you know, certain people seem to monopolize all the flexibility and other people kind of get left out. How do you deal with that? Is that where you have to fire that person or talk to them about, hey, you know what, you can't be sick so much, or you can't ask to work from home all the time because then nobody else gets to work from home. But you always seem to be wanting to do this, and then other, basically everyone's covered. How do you manage that out? Like, what do you do in that case?
Yeah. I think, you know, as companies evolve, there's certain people that should just be left at the bus stop. If they're not evolving and they're not in line, they're not behaving in the way that that culture, that organization is, which is some days you're going to have to just muck in and get stuff done. You can't be the person just because I'm going to work from home today because it's snowing outside and whatever, I'm going to work from home. Again, it's that belonging to the organization and the bigger thing and the accountability and the expectations that are set. Like, you don't want people like that in your organization. And again, it's generally is what I've found over the years with any kind of rule, HR policy, it's there for the 5% that are going to take the piss rather than the 95% that are trying to do the right thing. So actually, why don't we just get rid of them 5% and then we don't have to behave in this really, because actually as a smaller startup business, tech startup, whatever you're working in, you need to be agile, you need to be flexible. You're going to have to get to a point sometimes. It might be you've got a customer and they go, I need install in the evening or a weekend, and you're gonna go, actually, do you know that 9 to 5 that we've been pushing? We now need you to do this install at 8 o'clock at night. Sorry, that's part of your role now. So actually, you want them to go, yeah, no problem. Absolutely, that's not an issue. So I think that flexibility goes both ways. I think there's nothing more that irritates an employee than saying there's no flexibility. However, we now need you to do this outside of that flexibility. And then they're going, no, because we do 9 to 5 here. That's what we're doing. So I think it goes both ways. Obviously, I don't know much about your organization, so it'd be unfair for me to kind of put that into your world, but you know, it's yeah, there's it's got to be give and take, and I think that goes back to the relationship. And you know, you can say in some organizations right now where they've gone a whole 100% remote, it's getting too transactional. I don't like it. There's got to be a balance. So there's still got to be that relationship and connection, hence why I'm always going to be for the office.
And for all you lighting distributors out there, remember, it's going to be because of, look at the wonderful skylight lighting we have in our office, Greg Eric. KeystoneTech.com, Greg Eric, KeystoneTech.com, the big easy, the easy folks. What do they got today that's hot and exciting?
Their canopy fixture, convenience, versatility, and dependability for covered outdoor applications. They've got their Keystone driver built-in photo cell, color power select, capable sensors. Everything you need for a canopy fixture.
KeystoneTech.com, the big easy, and of course, the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors, Greg Eric. America's Lighting Convention is coming up in America with America's team, the Dallas Cowboys. We're going to take a tour of the stadium, do a bunch of other stuff, and we're going to learn a lot about lighting controls and lighting, health effects of lighting, and all sorts of stuff at the convention, aren't we, Greg Eric?
Well, that's right. That's what it's all about, learning, getting smarter, selling more.
NAILD.org, the old tagline, where lighting means business. I always love that. And of course, we give thanks to Simone Fenton Jarvis for coming on the show today. Her Twitter is @ChiefWorkplace. Her website, thehuman-centricworkplace.com. And of course, that'll be listed on the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast website. But to you, the listeners and the watchers and all those people out there, you know we don't have listeners and watchers. We only have colleagues that don't do podcasts. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.